Usually when we talk about diagnostic tools, there's this ingrained expectation of absolute precision.
Right. Like it's infallible.
Exactly. You think of something like a broken bone,
Yeah.
right? You go to the hospital, the doctor takes an X-ray, and you get that harsh, glowing white line on the
Yeah,
film.
it's very binary.
Yeah. The
Yeah.
doctor points to it and just says, there it is. That's the problem.
It's broken or it's not broken. It's clean. And honestly, it's very comforting. I mean, we're visual creatures, right? We like our data to be visible, categorized, and absolute.
Totally. But then you step out of the hospital and into the murky bleeding edge of modern science, and suddenly you realize that X-ray machine isn't just a simple camera anymore.
No, not at all.
The image you're looking at isn't a photograph. It's this massive, complex mathematical interpretation. And sometimes that interpretation just straight up lies to you.
It is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters because you aren't just looking at the physical world anymore. You're looking at what an algorithm thinks the physical world looks like.
Yes. And that idea of trusting an image, of rigorously questioning the incredibly complex tools we use to see the invisible. That is exactly what we're getting into today. So, welcome to the deep dive. We have a mission for you today.
We
We're
do.
going to unravel this wild scientific detective story, and it is hidden inside what might initially sound like the most intensely dense, specific metallurgical paper you could ever come across.
It is quite a formidable read, honestly. We are looking at a 2008 study published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society A. The title is Synchrotron X-ray Studies of Austenite and Bainitic Ferrite.
Now, I know what you might be thinking right now. A 2008 paper on the microscopic phase transformations of steel alloys sounds like someone is about to read you a textbook.
It does sound a bit dry on the surface.
But stick with us here, because this isn't just a story about steel. It's about the quest to create something called superbainite,
Right.
which is this cheap, bulk, nanostructured material that is so unfathomably strong it could fundamentally revolutionize modern engineering.
Absolutely.
But even more importantly than the material itself, this is a story about a ghost.
A ghost in the machine.
Exactly. A ghost hiding inside the data and the extreme, just mind-bending lengths that science has to go to in order to correct its own mistakes.
What's fascinating here is that it truly is a fundamental look at the scientific method in action. I mean, you have this massive paradigm-shifting claim made by a group of researchers, and then you have the painstaking, almost obsessive process of trying to verify that claim.
Okay, let's unpack this. We really have to set the scene first.
Yeah.
Because to understand why this 2008 paper matters, we have to look back at a previous study done by some of the very same researchers back in 2005. And that 2005 study found something entirely bizarre about how steel transforms. So, just basic metallurgy for a second. You take steel, you heat it up until its atoms rearrange into a specific structure called austenite,
The parent phase.
right, the parent phase. And then you rapidly cool it down so it transforms into a much stronger, tougher structure called bainite.
And that transformation is usually a very well understood progression. You know, the carbon inside the steel gets shuffled around as the temperature drops,
Okay.
and that leaves you with a final product that is a mix of the new bainitic ferrite and some carbon-enriched leftover austenite. That is the normal, completely expected end state.
Right, normal. But the 2005 study claimed they saw something impossible.
Yeah.
They claimed that right before the steel actually transformed into bainite, the parent structure of the austenite seemingly just split.
Yes.
Like without the temperature even dropping enough to start the reaction, the austenite spontaneously divided into two identical atomic structures, just with different densities.
Which is theoretically shocking. I mean, to put into perspective how wild that is, it basically broke the known laws of thermodynamics.
It's like putting a pot of water on the stove, and right before it boils, the water magically splits into a layer of super dense water and a layer of low density water, just out of nowhere.
That's a great
It
analogy.
makes absolutely no physical sense.
It doesn't. And what's fascinating here is that this anomaly caused absolute panic in the metallurgical community. I mean, thermodynamic theorists were literally pulling their hair out trying to rewrite the laws of physics to accommodate this impossible precursor split.
Wow, just from one paper.
From one paper. It was so disruptive that the researchers didn't just publish a quick follow-up. They packed up their equipment, secured a highly competitive time at the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility.
The ESRF.
Right, the ESRF in Grenoble, France.
Yeah.
And they decided to use one of the most powerful scientific instruments on the planet just to double-check their own math.
So they've essentially created a high-stakes staring contest with a tiny piece of steel.
Yes, exactly.
Which brings us to the setup, because if you want to solve a microscopic mystery, you need a bigger magnifying glass. And the ESRF is not just a magnifying glass.
Oh, not even close. It is a massive ring, nearly a kilometer in circumference, that accelerates electrons to near the speed of light.
Just casual.
Right. The resulting X-rays from that are 100 billion times brighter than the machine at your local hospital.
100 billion. That's insane.
Yeah.
And they needed that sheer brute force power because they couldn't just look at a, you know, a surface scratch on the metal. They used 60 kilo electron volt X-rays.
Massive energy.
At that energy level, the beam blasts completely through a solid millimeter thick cylinder of their steel alloy. So they were getting a true three-dimensional volumetric reading of the interior of the metal.
And the composition of that metal is very specific. They used an alloy of iron, 0.8% carbon, 1.5% silicon, and 2% manganese.
Okay.
But crucially, they sprinkled in tiny traces of cobalt and aluminum.
Wait, hold on. Let me stop you there. Because if the whole point is to study how this specific steel alloy behaves naturally to form superbainite.
Right.
Why are they intentionally contaminating it with cobalt and aluminum? Doesn't that completely skew the baseline data they're trying to collect?
It's a very valid concern, but honestly, it comes down to the realities of practical science, which is time management.
Oh, really?
Yeah. This specific mixture, which they call alloy 1 in the study, is fantastic for making superbainite because the transformation is incredibly slow.
Okay.
That slow speed lets you control the outcome beautifully. But synchrotron time costs an absolute fortune, and you usually only get a few hours on the machine.
I see. So they couldn't just sit there for 3 days waiting for the steel to do its thing.
Exactly. The cobalt and aluminum additions act as a thermodynamic catalyst. They accelerate the bainite reaction just enough so the researchers could actually observe the entire transformation process in a reasonable time frame.
Without getting kicked out of the facility.
Right, without getting kicked out and losing all their grant money. Oh.
Okay, that makes total sense. So we have this millimeter-thick cylinder of hot steel. They are blasting it with world-class lasers. But then they do something that sounds, honestly, almost comical to me.
The spinning.
Yes. Mm. They spin the sample, they put this tiny piece of metal on a rig, and spin it at 3,000 RPM while shooting it with X-rays. Why spin it? I mean, isn't that overkill? Feels like hanging a disco ball in a laboratory just to catch all the light.
You know, the disco ball analogy is actually the perfect way to visualize it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because when you bounce X-rays off a crystal lattice inside the metal, they only reflect perfectly into the detector if the angle of the crystal is exactly right.
Okay.
This is a fundamental physics principle called the Bragg condition.
So it's like catching the glare of the sun on your watch face. It only blinds you if you hold it at that one specific perfect angle.
Precisely. Now, in a tiny 1 millimeter sample of steel, you only have a limited number of microscopic crystals or grains. If you just leave the sample stationary, only a handful of those grains will accidentally be sitting at that perfect Bragg condition angle. So the data you get back will be spotty and weak.
Oh, I see.
But by spinning it at 3,000 RPM, you're constantly rotating thousands and thousands of new grains into the path of the beam.
You're forcing them into the glare.
Yes, you force them through that perfect angle.
Mm-hmm.
It drastically increases the population of grains contributing to the X-ray pattern, turning a faint signal into a loud, clear, continuous average.
Wow. It's smoothing out the raw data in real time.
Mm.
That is brilliant. But, you know, the mechanical spinning isn't even the most impressive feat they pulled off. The thermal manipulation they had to achieve here is just staggering.
It really is an engineering marvel in its own right.
Right, because if you're trying to freeze a highly volatile metallurgical process at the exact moment it changes, you can't just toss it in a freezer. Mm. To make bainite, you have to heat the steel up so it's purely austenite and then cool it down rapidly to a precise holding temperature.
In this case, 300 degrees Celsius.
Exactly. So they had two specialized hot air blowers mounted on a mechanical translation stage right under this spinning sample.
Just blowing air directly on it.
Yeah. One blower is blasting air at 1050 degrees Celsius, getting the steel up to around 832 degrees. Then they have to drop the temperature instantly. They literally move the 150-degree blower away and slide a 350-degree blower underneath the spinning sample.
And they executed this physical swap in exactly 4.96 seconds.
Less than 5 seconds.
And that speed is critical. If that swap takes too long, the sample undercools. It drops below the target temperature of 300 degrees, which would prematurely trigger the transformation.
Oh, bad news.
Very bad news. Or worse, it could trigger different unwanted phase changes that ruin the supergranite structure entirely.
Right.
But because they swapped the heat sources in under 5 seconds, the steel stabilized at exactly 300.5 degrees with a standard deviation of just 1.3 degrees.
It's like pulling a perfectly baked souffle out of one oven and throwing it into another oven without it falling.
Pretty much.
And the reward for this insane level of precision, the resolution they achieved. The researchers noted they were capable of detecting a 0.0005 angstrom difference in the atomic lattice.
To give you a sense of scale there, an angstrom is 1/10 billionth of a meter.
Good grief.
We are talking about detecting a change in the physical distance between atoms that is a tiny fraction of the width of a single atom.
So the ultimate trap is set. We have the world's brightest X-rays, a spinning disco ball of steel, and thermal control down to the degree. The temperature stabilizes at 300 degrees. So what does this multi-million dollar magnifying glass actually see? Let's talk about the real-time atomic events.
Well, once the sample hits that 300 degree sweet spot, the X-ray data just starts pouring in.
Okay.
During the first few hours, the bainitic ferrite develops beautifully. The diffraction peaks for the ferrite start growing on the monitor.
Right, the transformation is happening.
Yes, and eventually the reaction slows down and stops, leaving the steel at roughly 83% bainitic ferrite.
Which means the remaining 17% of it is left as the original parent phase, the austenite.
Correct.
But here's where it gets really interesting. Remember that bizarre 2005 claim that the austenite split into two different populations before the reaction started?
The impossible split.
Right. Well, the new data showed that the austenite does split into two populations.
Mm.
But it happens during the transformation, not before.
Exactly. It's a reactive split, not a spontaneous precursor split. As the superbainite forms, you end up with two distinct types of austenite remaining in the steel.
Okay, what are they?
One is the original unenriched austenite, often called bulk or blocky austenite. The other is what we call film austenite.
And this film austenite is the key to the whole mystery because these superbainite plates are unbelievably thin. We're talking 20 to 40 nanometers thick.
Mm-hmm.
And sandwiched intimately between those microscopic plates of bainite are these trapped ultra-thin films of austenite.
Mm-hmm.
But why does the X-ray see them as two entirely different things? Why does the single X-ray peak for the austenite suddenly split in two as the bainite grows?
It all comes down to carbon, specifically a process called a diffusionless transformation.
Okay, define diffusionless for me. Because usually when I think of metals transforming or mixing, I picture the atoms wandering around and bumping into each other like, you know, people mingling at a crowded party.
And normally you'd be right. That is diffusion. But a diffusionless transformation is more like a military drill.
Oh.
Yeah. The iron atoms don't wander around. They collectively, instantaneously shift their grid pattern to form the new bainite lattice. It's a sudden, highly coordinated movement.
Got it. But what about the carbon atoms that are trapped inside that original grid?
That is the structural problem. The new bainite grid, the physical atomic box, so to speak, cannot hold as much carbon as the old austenite grid did.
Oh, I see.
So as this bainite plate suddenly snaps into existence, it forcefully ejects its excess carbon out into the remaining untransformed austenite surrounding it.
It's like trying to build a brick wall, but half of your bricks are slightly too big. You keep laying the courses, but you have to aggressively shove all the oversized bricks into the mortar joints between the walls.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. And if you keep shoving oversized bricks into the mortar, what happens to the wall?
The mortar physically stretches, right? The whole structure starts bowing outward to make room.
Precisely. Carbon atoms take up physical space. When you pump extra carbon into the austenite crystal lattice, it stretches. The physical distance between the iron atoms expands to accommodate the new carbon.
Oh, wow.
And because the lattice is now physically larger, it reflects the X-rays at a slightly different angle. Hence, the X-ray detector suddenly sees two distinct peaks. The original normal-sized blocky austenite and the newly stretched carbon-stuffed film austenite.
And those X-ray peaks for the carbon-rich film austenite weren't perfectly smooth, right? They were asymmetric, like they kind of dragged out on one side of the graph.
They did, and the researchers proved this wasn't an instrument error. Yeah, the asymmetry happens because the carbon isn't distributed perfectly evenly in the mortar, to use your analogy.
Yeah.
The austenite right up against the bainite plate gets a massive immediate dose of carbon, so it stretches a lot.
Right.
The austenite a little further away gets less carbon, so it stretches less. You have a gradient of carbon concentration, which creates a gradient of lattice stretching, which then drags the X-ray peak out asymmetrically.
Which elegantly explains another mystery in the paper, the incomplete reaction phenomenon.
Hmm.
Thermodynamics suggests that more of the steel should turn into bainite, but it just stops at 83%.
It has to stop. The surrounding austenite mortar becomes so incredibly stretched and choked with rejected carbon that it physically stabilizes.
It's too full.
Exactly. It becomes structurally impossible for the bainite to keep growing into it. The reaction halts on its own long before thermodynamic equilibrium is ever reached.
Okay, so this beautifully explains the true reality of the superbainite transformation. The military shift happens. The excess carbon gets shoved out, the austenite lattice stretches, and the reaction eventually chokes itself out.
Yes.
We've seen exactly what happens during the transformation. But wait, what about the ghost? What about the 2005 claim that the austenite miraculously split before any of this carbon shoving even started?
Ah, to finally put that ghost to rest, the researchers had to run one more crucial experiment. They brought in alloy 2.
Right, alloy 2, the slowpoke alloy.
Exactly. Alloy 2 does not have the cobalt and aluminum accelerators mixed in. And instead of dropping the temperature to 300 degrees, they dropped it down to 200 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
At 200 degrees, without those catalysts, the bainite transformation is so agonizingly slow that it takes days just to initiate.
So it's the ultimate staring contest. They actually refer to it in the paper as the long-time experiment.
They do.
They held this spinning cylinder of alloy 2 at 200 degrees for 10 straight hours in the synchrotron. Absolutely no bainite is forming. It is purely just the parent austenite sitting there getting blasted by X-rays.
Right.
And if the 2005 paper was right, if the austenite magically splits into two different densities before the reaction begins, this is exactly where you would catch it red-handed.
And what did that exhaustive 10-hour X-ray scan show?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Zero peak splitting occurred. The austenite remained perfectly, completely homogeneous for 10 solid hours.
The spontaneous precursor split simply does not exist.
Okay, then I have a serious problem with this. If the 2005 study saw a split, and this hyper-advanced study saw nothing, we have a massive contradiction here, were the first scientists just seeing things? Was it a smudge on the telescope lens? Like, did they just make it up?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the answer is far more insidious than a smudge on a lens. And they certainly didn't make it up.
Okay.
It was a ghost in the machine. Or, more accurately, a ghost in the code. The true culprit was software integration artifacts.
Okay, break that down for me. How does a piece of software invent a physical phenomenon that breaks the laws of thermodynamics?
Well, we have to look at how the 2005 study recorded its data. They used a 2D area detector to capture the X-rays. Think of the detector like a digital camera sensor taking a picture of the diffraction pattern.
Okay, which shows up as a series of glowing concentric rings, right?
Yes. Now, because they weren't spinning the sample at 3,000 RPM back in 2005, they weren't forcing those grains through the Bragg condition.
So instead of solid, smooth rings of light, they got spotty, broken rings. Just a few bright dots scattered around the circles.
Exactly. Now, the software's job is to take that 2D picture of a spotty ring and integrate it. Essentially, it needs to measure the radius of the ring and collapse it down into a simple 1D line graph showing a single peak.
Okay.
But to do that math accurately, the software absolutely must know exactly where the physical center of the X-ray beam is on the detector.
Let me see if I'm tracking this. Imagine a dartboard, right? If you know exactly where the bullseye is, you can perfectly measure the distance of every dart sitting in the outer rings.
That's right. But the researchers in this new 2008 study deliberately tested the old software parameters. They asked a terrifying question. What happens if the software thinks the bullseye is just 10 pixels to the left of where it actually is?
Well, if the center is off, the math is completely ruined. Half of the darts in the ring will look like they are closer to the center, and the other half will look like they are further away.
Yes. And when the software tries to plot those distances on a 1D graph, it doesn't know it made a calibration mistake.
Oh
It
no.
just blindly plots the data it calculated at two different distances. So instead of drawing one sharp peak for one ring, it draws two distinct peaks. It artificially creates a doublet.
That is mind-blowing. The math literally hallucinates a second crystal lattice.
It gets worse. If the physical detector was tilted by just 5 degrees, which is incredibly easy to do by accident in a crowded lab, and the software didn't account for it perfectly, it does the exact same thing.
Oh my God.
The software squishes the circular ring into an oval, measures two different radii, and generates a false split peak.
So the ghost wasn't in the steel at all. It was entirely in the data processing.
Entirely.
The X-rays hit the metal just fine in 2005. But the algorithm translating the raw visual data into a readable graph miscalculated by 10 tiny pixels, and it birthed a scientific anomaly that spawned years of agonizing theoretical debate.
And the 2008 team proved it definitively. Any peak that is genuinely physically split, like the ones we see during the carbon partitioning, cannot be unsplit by introducing tilt errors into the software.
Right.
But a single solid peak can easily be distorted into a double peak by slightly bad math. By proving that the software could artificially generate the exact same split seen in 2005, they fully exercised the ghost.
Wow. So what does this all mean? We started with mystery about splitting steel, and we ended up with a profound lesson in digital geometry. The ultimate takeaway from the metallurgy side is incredibly clear. The austenite does not mysteriously split before transforming.
It doesn't.
The bainite transformation is a diffusionless military shift. The carbon is shoved out after the plates form, and the lattice stretches as a physical result. This deep dive proves that we actually do understand the mechanisms of this material, which means we are on the right track to reliably manufacturing cheap, ultra-strong superbainite for the real world.
But there is a much larger lesson here that extends far beyond metallurgy. This raises an important question about how we conduct science today.
Yeah.
Critical thinking isn't just about doubting the subject you are studying. It is about rigorously, constantly doubting the tools you use to study it. The researchers in 2005 weren't bad scientists. They just trusted the output of their processing software a little too much without realizing how utterly delicate the math behind that output really was.
And that leads me to a final thought for you to mull over. We live in an era where almost all of our scientific data is mediated by software. Human eyes rarely look directly through physical lenses anymore.
It's true.
Think about the James Webb Space Telescope, sending out the raw data that is stitched together into breathtaking photos. Think about fMRI machines analyzing blood flow in the brain to diagnose neurological conditions, or the digital sensors inside a particle accelerator hunting for new physics. The data is processed, smooth, integrated, and interpreted by algorithms long before a human ever looks at it.
Before we ever see it.
Right. So it makes you wonder, as we push further into the microscopic and the cosmic, how many other fundamental truths of our universe sitting in published papers right now are actually just 10 pixel errors waiting to be corrected? Because as we've seen today, sometimes the X-ray machine isn't broken. Sometimes the algorithm is just drawing a line that isn't really there.